So we're looking for this big picture of marriage, this big picture of a relationship that gives us direction, that keeps us from playing hit or miss in the way that we try to work on our problems. And we are focusing in on this first great commandment. So we are under number 2 on your outline. I'll try to do a better job of helping you know where I'm at on the outline here. Under the heading of the first great commandment. So basically, Jesus gives us this first great commandment as a summary. And I'm suggesting that it seems to me that's a positive statement. That's a statement of your positive duties. And if you start teasing apart that summary, then what do you have? Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, mind, soul, and strength. What does it mean to love the Lord your God with all of your heart? Many of you, anybody who's been around the CCF for very long knows that we're real big on this language of the heart. Not just because it's a biblical word, but because it's such a helpful word and that it's really a global descriptor of everything that you are on the inside. Rather than having to kind of break you down into little pieces every time we talk about your inner world, we can talk about your heart. But one of the very important things that the Scripture teaches us about the heart is that it is essentially the control center of who you are as a person. The Bible describes human beings as those who live out of the fullness of their heart. Whatever is happening on the inside is going to flow to the outside. Proverbs 4:23 puts it this way: above all else, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. Now, most of us don't have a wellspring in our backyards anymore because we just turn on the spigot and the water comes out. But what is a wellspring? It's the point at which water, emerges from the ground and flows over the land. And you want to be drinking your water as close to the wellspring as possible, right? Because it's going to be at its purest where it emerges from the ground. And if the stream is polluted at any point along the stream, what is true of all the water downstream from that point? It is polluted as well, right? Well, if your wellspring itself is polluted, you're in big trouble. Because from the wellspring, everything that flows out of the wellspring then is corrupt. And the Bible is saying your heart is like a wellspring. Everything in your life flows out of your heart, right? Everything you say, everything you do, every aspect of your relationships, every aspect of your marriage, everything flows out of your heart. So if your heart is corrupted, everything you touch in your life is going to end up being corrupted. So we're told to really guard our hearts. So if Jesus is commanding you to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, he's basically saying, let your love of God function as your control center. Let your love of God rule you. Let your love of God determine everything that flows out of your life. And then Jesus adds these other terms, which in many ways just give us different aspects of the whole, different aspects of your heart or different aspects of your life. Love the Lord your God with all of your mind. Your mind is part of your inner world as well. Your mind kind of helps you structure and understand your experience of reality. But when you are thinking, what directs your thinking? What helps you determine what's true and not true? What do you use to structure your experience of reality? What controls your mind? When you apply your mind to something, what is really governing it? Christ is saying, let your love of God structure the very way you think about things, the very way you approach the unknown, the way you approach the known. The way you structure your understanding of the world should be controlled by your love of God. Love the Lord your God with all of your soul. And I would just say the way that the New Testament uses the word soul, often it's just a synonym for a living being. It means to be alive. It means to be a creature. The Bible will refer to you as a living soul, with all your life, right? With all of your life, as a living being, love God. And he qualifies that further by talking about strength. What do you apply your energies to? To what do you apply most of your energies? Where do you place your efforts in life? Let all of that be guided by your love of God. Now, I don't think Jesus is trying to give us some kind of formal anthropology here, you know, trying to help us divide people up into different chunks. He's coming at you from a lot of different angles in a way to kind of give you no escape, to kind of say with the totality of everything you are, however many ways you want to cut the pie, however many ways you think of being a human being, the totality of that personhood is to be driven by your love of God. It is, in some ways, kind of a terrifying definition of worship, isn't it? It basically means God wants the entirety of your life to be swallowed up by your relationship with Him. He calls you to live life, to be busy with many things, to apply yourself to being an image bearer in His creation. But all of your ways of doing that, all of your approaches to it, are to be driven by this love of God that encompasses your whole being. That's amazing, incredibly challenging, obviously. Just as an example of how that maybe fleshes out in life, if you look at Psalm 71, I think of Psalm 71 as really a nice picture of the comprehensiveness of worship. I won't read all of Psalm 71 to you, but as I skip through different verses of it, I mean, let's keep asking the question, in how many different ways, in how many different roles does God serve in this person's life? In how many different ways does the psalmist relate his heart, mind, soul, and strength to God? Notice he does not, as we read this, he does not keep God in the teeny-tiny little box that he only opens on Sunday morning. God is all over, in, and through this person's life. So let's just skim some of this. Psalm 71, look at verse 5. Well, no, I'm sorry. Let's start back at verse 1 and 2. In you, O Lord, I have taken refuge. Let me never be put to shame. Rescue me and deliver me in your righteousness. Turn your ear to me and save me. Okay, so what does it mean for him to worship God? Well, for one thing, it means to know God as his rescuer, right? And every time we notice a particular way in which God is worshiped, it then becomes a diagnostic question for us. Who is my worshiper? Who is my worshiper? Oh, yeah, yeah. Who is my rescuer, right? Where do I look for rescue? Because that's an indicator of what I worship. The thing to which, or the person to whom I look for rescue the most, is functioning as really kind of a God in my life. Skip down to verse 5. For you have been my hope, O sovereign Lord, my confidence since my youth. From birth I have relied on you. You brought me forth from my mother's womb. Okay? Your God is the one in whom you hope, the one in whom you have confidence, the one on whom you rely. And then the question becomes for us, well, where is my confidence? On whom do I rely? In what do I hope? Is it my skills in my job? Is it my money, my earning power? Is it my reputation? Is it my ability to command and control others? Is it my secret escapes? Is it alcohol, pornography, television, ice cream? Right? You start thinking about worship in this comprehensive way, and you start seeing there are gods and goddesses lurking all over the place. Everything in the created order begins to offer itself to me as a god or a goddess, because I want to put my confidence and my hope in these created things that seem so immediate to me and so instantly gratifying to me. Look down to verse 8. My mouth is filled with your praise, declaring your splendor all day long. What do you praise? And I came from a pretty fairly conservative religious upbringing. Praise, when I was growing up, meant just singing hymns. And I never really thought of, praise was never really an active category for me. Well, so, and I don't know if it's an active category for you, but I tend to have even the word praise kind of in a little box. Praise is what you do when you're clapping and singing or raising your hands. But really, praise is all around us too. A very generic definition of praise would be it's an activity, it's adoration that comes out of your mouth that calls other people to join you in that adoration, in your appreciation of something. And I often think that for men, a good way to watch them praise is to listen to them as they're watching a sports on TV, you know? Then praise starts coming out of their mouths, you know, and they say, "Wow, did you see that pass? Man, you know, those Eagles are really something." Or "Man, that guy is the best jumper in the NBA. Man, he can really dunk that ball." That's praise. Not necessarily in a sinful way, but I'm just saying, what attracts your attention? What do you find so admirable or desirable that it will erupt from your mouth that you will call others to join with you in doing it? Hey, maybe for women, it's, you know, listen to them talk about a wedding or something, you know. "Did you see that bride? She was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And those flowers, I mean, you could just touch the smell of those flowers. It was so sweet, and that cake was beautiful." Or I don't know, just whatever you like. What gets the most praise? And then diagnostically, does the beauty of God move me? Does His glory, who He is, His character, His love, His mercy, His sacrifice for me in Christ, does that move me to praise, to call attention to it in the presence of others? Interesting question, challenging question. You get the idea. We could go on and on through that psalm. But to say you cannot keep worship contained in a little box, you can't keep your obligations to God contained in a little box, under this heading, a very broad understanding of worship. You know, we tend to want to, if you ask the Joe Blow on the street out here on, you know, the city streets of Philadelphia, kind of did a man on the street interview, "Sir, could you tell me what worship is?" The kinds of answers you would get, I predict, would be, "Yeah, you know, worship, it's that thing that you do on a particular day of the week. It involves very specific activity. Sometimes you have to kneel. Sometimes you have to pray. Somebody gets up and talks for a little bit. Maybe you have to light candles. Inevitably, somebody passes a plate and you have to put money in it." Right? These are worship. These are worshiping activities. And then at some point, I will leave that place of worship and I will no longer be worshiping. I start worship and I stop worship and I keep it very contained and controlled. And this understanding of worship just busts out all over the place. I can't contain it. I can't control it. I can't stop my worshiping activity, because every moment of every day I'm loving something. Something is guiding me. Something's controlling me. I am pursuing some desire in life, or I'm moving away from some fear, but something is steering me internally. Something is controlling my heart and my mind and my efforts, you know, and my strength. What is it? That becomes the question. And Jesus' command is only one is allowed to hold that place in your life. Also, this gives us a very functional or visible definition. If everything in my life is driven by worship, that means I can look at you. You can look at me. You can watch me live, and you can know exactly who my God is and what my life is about. Especially in relationship, because God has wired us, right, to be relational. And God is relational. He gives us a relational focus to our lives. I watch you in relationship, and your relationship proclaims to me that which you serve. My activity, my behavior in relationships is a proclamation to you of that which I serve. And as we live in relationship in front of each other, we are sort of calling each other to worship, right? We're sort of pushing and pulling each other to conform to our view of what life and the world is about, and ultimately who God is. So the fact that you live out of worship all the time means your relationship is a proclamation of what you worship. Your marriage, Bob and Betty's marriage, tell us about their hearts and what they worship. This might be a good point to pause and try to answer that question. If we look at Bob and Betty, and we say, what are they living out of? What steers their life? There are probably a lot of ways that we could answer it. But I would say Bob is a person who very much wants life to be comfortable. He's very much looking for a place of ease and a place of escape. I would say he wants safety and comfort. And because that's what he worships in his life, he organizes his very family around it. He recruits his wife and his children to be servants in that temple. And to the extent that they either serve or don't serve, they get his praise or his rejection. But Bob, even though he takes the name of Christ and is sincere in doing it, he doesn't see himself. He doesn't see his own heart and how he's really all about this love and service of comfort. And it rules his heart and his mind and his very soul. And all of his strength goes towards orchestrating these moments of escape and pleasure that will keep him going. And Betty's a worshiper too, right? What does Betty worship? Well, Betty worships at this temple of intimacy, or at maybe the temple of romance. And see, what you'll notice as I'm talking here is like, romance sounds like a good thing. Comfort and peace sounds like a good thing. But they've taken the place of the one and only, right? They're things that can be good in their place, but they've in fact pushed God out of their life. Their love for God and their love of neighbor is not really on the radar screen for them. Rather, it's her pursuit of romance and looking for these relationship connections and the affirmation and approval that come out of intimacies. That's what she craves. It's what she organizes her life around. And she wants Bob and the kids to serve in her temple. And so it's not that she doesn't love her kids, but in a lot of ways her kids become avenues for her to get that connection. And because Bob will not willingly serve in her temple, then she can't really love him anymore. And as soon as your devotion to something eclipses your love of God and neighbor, guess what? It's an idol. You've violated the law. Your inability to love your neighbor reveals your inability, your unwillingness to truly worship God. I can see it in your relationship. I can see it in Bob and Betty's relationship. If you watch me long enough, or you ask my wife, you'll see it in my relationships. You can start to detect, hey, there's a theme. You're organizing your heart, mind, your soul, and strength around something, and it's not quite right. And that seems to be this diagnostic process that Jesus walks people through. What is your problem? What are you doing? Why are you doing it? Ultimately, who is God and what do you serve? So it's a functional, visible definition of worship. It's also an inclusive, universal definition of worship. It applies to all human beings. I don't care whether you think you're religious or not. But given that broad definition that's unescapable, you do worship something. Something, you've organized your life around something. And it's interesting, in Romans chapter 1, you don't have to turn there, but Paul's wrestling with this division that was very powerful in the New Testament church, the division between Jew and Gentile. And Paul has to kind of work hard to try to get them on the same page because they see huge differences between Jew and Gentile, their whole worldview. But in Romans chapter 1, the groundwork that Paul lays to put Jew and Gentile on common ground is the common ground of worship. And in Romans chapter 1, verses 22 and 23, he puts it this way, describing the condition of all humanity regardless of who they are. Paul says, "For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. But their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles." In other words, when they stopped worshiping God, they didn't stop worshiping. They just exchanged the worship of God for the worship of something else that wasn't God, some created thing. Because you only have two things in the universe, right? God and the things he created. So if you're not going to worship God, you're going to worship something else. And then Paul explains By the way, when you make this exchange, creator for idol, guess what happens? You will experience an exchange in your behavior. You will experience a change in the way you relate to your neighbor, right? You'll exchange the behavior of someone who loves God for the behavior of someone who doesn't love God. You won't be able to love your neighbor successfully. And Paul goes on to give us this example of homosexuality, not by any means saying this is the granddaddy of all sins, but this is a beautiful picture of an exchange. In Paul's mind, what could be a more obvious of exchange in behaviors as a man wanting to have sex with a man instead of with a woman? But then he goes on to catalog all the kinds of exchanges you might see. So it's important to see that this definition of worship includes everybody. So I don't just think this way when I'm talking to people who are believers. I think this way no matter who I'm talking to, no matter whom I'm trying to whom I'm trying to minister. Under this heading, worship is transformational. Here's another key idea. It's a basic principle in Scripture that what you worship will transform you, or you will become like the thing which you worship. You will become like that which you worship. And I think it's interesting how in our culture we'll use the very language of idolatry to talk about movies and music, and how people will have idols. A movie star who becomes their idol, or a musician that becomes their idol. And I know they don't mean it in the way that we're talking about here, but in some ways it fits. You know, I've been amazed over the last few years how many midriffs and belly buttons I've seen. I think in the last 2 years I've seen more belly buttons than I've seen in my whole life. Especially girls like between the ages of 12 and 15. I'm like, where did all these belly buttons come from? I mean, I knew they had them before, but I was never invited to look at them. And then they're pierced, a lot of them too. What's happened here? And I'm not going to blame this all on one person, but I have to confess, I suspect Britney Spears has a lot to do with these belly buttons emerging. And how does that happen? I think the way that it happens is, you know, 11 or 12-year-old girl, first of all, she hears her friends talking about some musician. Well, I'll say Britney Spears, not to pick on her, but just as an example. And she hears the name, then she starts hearing the songs on the radio. Right, and at first the tune is catchy, and then slowly she starts listening to the words, and the words are all about her adventures with boys and how boys like her, and the excitement and the fun of relationship and the naughtiness of relationship, and it's all very seductive and it sounds wonderful. And after a few weeks of listening to those songs, she says, "This is really about me. You know, this is Brittany gets me. You know, she understands me." And she buys the CDs, right? And then the posters go up. And then she starts asking you if she can go to the concert. And of course you say no, but you have a big fight over it. Or maybe you say yes, I don't know. But as she meditates on Brittany, as she listens to the songs of Brittany, all of a sudden she starts looking like Brittany. And you start seeing her belly button, not because her shirts are shrinking, But because she worships this image, this idea of what it means to show your belly button. And what does it say about your life and how cool you are and how guys like you or whatever it is. And for guys, they have their own little idols. I remember when I was just to pick on somebody else and to show you an idolater I've been, I know that when I was 8, 9, and 10, I really liked Clint Eastwood. Not just because he had cool movies, but because to me, you know, I was going to school. It was kind of rough. There was a lot of fighting. I got picked on quite a bit. To me, see, Clint Eastwood movies represented the idea that if you're cool enough and you're tough enough, you can get out of any situation, and you can be cool while you're doing it. So is Clint Eastwood a good actor? Yeah, I guess so. But it was more than that to me. It was my heart gravitated toward it. I set my mind on it, and I wanted it to transform me. I wanted to become like that which I worship. I remember when I was about, well, I was 4 or 5. I remember my dad getting ready for work, and he used these flip-top razors. You know, you turn the bottom, and the thing opens up, and you put the razor in there. He'd be getting ready for work, and I would want to shave while he's shaving. So my parents had like a double sink. So I would shave in this sink, and he would shave in this sink. He would give me a razor, you know, the flip-top without the razor in it. And I would put my lather on my face, and I would do whatever he's doing. You know, I'd do like this, or I'd do like this. And I remember asking him, am I ever going to really be able to shave? Or am I always going to be pretending, you know? Dad, when am I going to be able to shave? Or am I going to be able to shave? And he said, of course you're going to be able to shave. And I was like, why? You know, what's so of course about that? He said, because you're my son. I shave. Right? And if I shave, you're my son. You're going to grow up and you're going to shave too. What's he saying? It's the most natural thing in the world, right? You become like that which you are joined to, which you are united to. Ultimately, you become like that which you worship. And in a positive way, this is the picture that you find in 1 John chapter 3, where John talks about our destiny as Christians. He says, how great is the love the Father has lavished on us that we should be called children of God. That's what we are. The reason the world does not know us is that it did not know Him. In other words, the world doesn't know your daddy, so guess what? It doesn't know you either. Dear friends, now we are children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made known. But we know that when He appears, we'll be like Him, for we'll see Him as He is. In other words, if you don't become like God, there's no way you can get to see Him. Because if you see God in His holiness and you're not holy, zap, right? You're dead. You don't know exactly what you're going to be like when He comes, but you know you're going to be like Him because you're going to be able to see Him. Everyone who has this hope in Him purifies himself just as He is pure. This love, this devotion, this worship of God has a transforming effect on your life because you become like that which you love. Your desire is to be with the one you love. So you become like the one that you worship. Now, the scary thing is that's true negatively as well. That if you worship idols, you will in fact become like an idol. Not in the sense that you'll be admired, not that you'll be an idol to other people, but you will become like an idol. And that, what is an idol? Well, in the Old Testament, it was a literal statue, something that they might actually worship and have in their home. But what is an idol? It's a lifeless, dead piece of stone or wood. What happens to idolaters? They become dead. They become devoid of life. Not just because ultimately God judges and condemns idolaters, but it's a process of dying. If you look at Psalm 115, you get a picture of this effect of idolatry. When you look at the first verses, say 4 through 7, here's a picture of an idol. Their idols are silver and gold, made by the hands of men. They have mouths but cannot speak, eyes but they cannot see. They have ears but cannot hear, noses but they cannot smell. They have hands but cannot feel, feet but cannot walk, nor can they utter a sound with their mouths or throats. So these idols have all the parts of a human being, but none of them work because it's made of stone. Look at verse 8. Those who make them will be like them, and so will all who trust in them. The one who serves idols ends up dead like an idol. And the process sneaks up on you sometimes. Think about Bob. The man worships comfort. The man worships escape and safety. And the more he pursues it, does he get more life? Does he become more alive? No, his eyes become more narrowed. He's able to see less and less of what's really going on. His ears become dull. He can't hear what he's doing to people. His hands, his feet become paralyzed because he's curled up in a fetal position in bed when he doesn't get what he wants. He's dying a spiritual death. His life becoming narrow and closed in and shut down by what idolatry is doing to him. Betty's the same way. You think studying these romance novels is adding romance to her life? You think she feels more loved because she reads romance novels? And no, she has less and less and less because she seeks that escape. She actually reaches out less and less and less. And the longer her eyes are trained on those books, the less they see anything else. The longer she revels in the imaginary world of other people, the less she does to live in her own world. And death creeps into her relationship with her husband. And she doesn't even realize it. Ultimately, under the heading here, all idolatry is about self-worship. One of the tricky things about idolatry is while it seems to be directed at something external to myself, it seems that I look outside of myself to find something to help me, to rescue me, to comfort me. What is idolatry really about? It's really an expression of what you see in Genesis 3. It's about man and woman saying to themselves, who is God? Does God care about me? I think I care about me. I think I'm going to start making these decisions about what's right. I'm going to decide what my life is about. I'll determine where I'm going to find life, meaning, and happiness and purpose. And I don't want God telling me that. All idolatry is ultimately a veiled, worshiping way of serving the self. It's about self-service, self-preservation, me looking out for me, me taking the place of God and figuring out the way the world's going to run. How can I make the world spin the direction I want it to go so that it works for me? Which helps you appreciate, you know, the utter wickedness of sin. It is satanic because all sin is rooted in this exaltation of the self and this desire to play God. That's why sin is worthy of death, because there are no boo-boos in the world of sin. You know, it's all about high treason. It's all about a desire to eradicate God and replace him. That's why it's all serious. All right. So where have we been so far? All of that to say, this understanding of worship and its comprehensiveness and its totality is going to require us to take it into account when we look at our relationships. I'm not going to be able to understand my marriage or any relationship if I don't know who I am as a worshiper, because that worship shapes everything that flows out of my life, right? Especially my relationships. So if I'm going to be transformed in my own marriage and or be useful in the relationships and marriages of other people, I'm going to have to be on top of this worship thing. I'm going to have eyes for how it works and be able to spot it, you know, when it's happening. Now, under this heading, the second great commandment. If you want to, you can flip back to Christ's summary in Matthew 22. And you'll notice that, oddly, Jesus is asked for one commandment, right? Which is the greatest commandment in the law? Jesus gives him two commandments. Now, did Jesus mishear the question? Or why does Jesus respond with two commandments when he's only asked for one? And here I think a little context is helpful. When Jesus gives this summary, he's entered into Jerusalem for the final week of his earthly ministry before the crucifixion. He is in the temple courts every day preaching and teaching. So he's really kind of on the, you might say he's on the turf of the experts in the law. And man, they are not happy. They are out to get him. That's why they're asking these questions, trying to trip him up. So when the experts in the law ask this question, what is the single most or what is the greatest commandment? Jesus offers them two instead of one because of the nature of these false teachers, really because of the nature of sinners. What are these Pharisees and these teachers of the law like? Listen to what Jesus says in Matthew, in the very next chapter, verse 23. Here's how Jesus describes them, one of the many places Jesus describes them in their problems. He says, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin, but you have neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former. You blind guides, you strain out a gnat, but swallow a camel." In other words, these experts in the law, you might say they're experts in some parts of the law. Which parts of the law are they experts in? The ceremonial parts of the law. You know, they're really into tithing. Man, they go out in their backyard and they tithe out of their mint garden, their herb garden. They are not going to miss a single obligation to tithe. In some way, that's very commendable, right? We ought to take those commandments seriously. But as they strain out that little gnat, as they strain out this aspect of the law, they swallow a camel in the process. Why? Because they don't care about people. They're hateful and hurtful towards their neighbor. They are not. They don't live for justice. They are not merciful. They are not faithful. On the one hand, they seem so on fire to do what honors God, and at the very same time, in their zeal to honor God, they trash people. Jesus is unwilling for them to live this compartmentalized kind of life. Now, but don't the Pharisees, teachers of law, teach us something about ourselves? As sinners, it's very convenient for me if I can compartmentalize and figure out a way to make God happy in this little area of my life so the rest of my life becomes a playground for my desires. If you think about it, the ceremonial aspects of the law are pretty easy. You know? I mean, I think they had worked it out so that they could do it, in a sense. Get those sacrifices done on time in the right way. And in some ways, they dumbed down the law to make it more doable. But the one part that will drive you crazy, the law, is how it makes you love the people around you. Because that's hard. It's hard loving the people around you because they keep messing up your plans. They keep interfering with all those idols that you want to serve. Doggone it, if it weren't for Betty and those kids, I could have a comfortable life, right? If it weren't for that old Bob, I don't know why I married him anyway, I could have romance in my life, right? It's the people that keep getting in the way. See, that's the part of the law that really bugs me. And if I could figure out a way to make the law, if I could just jump through the right hoops to keep God happy and do what I want the rest of my life, man, that would just be wonderful. That's kind of the way the Pharisees think, and it's kind of the way all of us are tempted to think and to live, to make the worship of God easy in a way that excludes my obligation to love the people around me. Micah 6, verses 6 to 8, kind of put it this way. "With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He showed you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with your God." Now notice what Jesus is saying here. You should have done the former without neglecting the latter. Jesus is not saying everything reduces to love of neighbor in abstraction from God. And at the same time, he's not willing to say everything is about loving God and it has nothing to do with people. In a sense, by giving two commands, he's giving us two aspects of one command. Now, there is a difference here. I don't love people in the same way that I love God. I can't turn people into idols. I can only love God with all of my heart, mind, soul, and strength. But Jesus is saying, when you're loving God with all of your heart, mind, soul, and strength, that's going to have a ripple effect in your life. It's going to change the way you interact with people. And one of your most important acts of worship of God is loving your neighbor. Can you follow what I'm saying? You worship God and love your neighbor because God is love. And when you worship Him, you're going to be a loving person. You're going to love people. It's not always going to feel good. It's not going to be easy. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying you're going to have the kind of focus that God has. He cares about relationship. He cares about love. So I want you to understand, it's hard for me to nuance it as carefully as it deserves to be nuanced in the kind of time we have. But basically you have two commands because of our sinful inclination to tease the law apart and do what's easier for us. And Jesus saying, these two commands hang together. You can't separate them. In a sense, they're aspects of one central command. Okay, so let me keep moving here before we have to take our break. How do I, in fact, then love my neighbor? Actually, let me qualify a little bit further. This second great commandment, to love your neighbor as yourself. I mean, there's in the past 15 or 20 years, kind of in the wake of the whole self-esteem movement, there's been a lot of playing around this with this verse that teaches that you're in fact being commanded to love yourself, and I don't want to get into a long kind of exegetical battle on that score, except to say there are only two commands in this summary: to love God and to love neighbor. And this idea of loving your neighbor as yourself, that really is that as yourself is a qualifier. It teaches you how to love your neighbor, and it assumes something about sinners. It assumes that the nature of the sinner is always to exalt the self. And therefore, because you're always inclined to exalt yourself, your temptation is going to be to treat yourself differently than others, to give yourself special exemptions, right? And that's what Jesus is getting after. You love your neighbor, don't give yourself special exemptions. You know, what is required of everyone is required of you. You have to love them, and you're not allowed to kind of let yourself off the hook, you know, and lay requirements on them that you, in fact, aren't willing to take up for yourself. That's what that's about, not about sitting around meditating on how wonderful you are. Because when you're doing that, you're probably not loving people. The longer you sit around meditating how wonderful you are, I think your odds go down of living in love. Okay, but how do we even know what this love looks like? How do you do it? I'm going to give you just two quick passages in 1 John, and then I'll unpack some of these other passages that are on your outline. We're still under this heading of the second great commandment, by the way. 1 John 4:16 says something very simple. God is love. God is love. And the important thing to realize there, that love doesn't just exist as kind of an abstract idea or a set of concrete actions. Ultimately, love is a person. Love is defined by who God is. Love is a person. And then the second thing that I want you to see in the book of 1 John is 1 John 3:16, which says, this is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down His life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. So here's the basic equation. God is love, and Jesus has showed us God's love. If you want to know what love is, then you need to look at Jesus. You ought to be looking at who He is. Okay? God is love, and Jesus shows us God's love. And ultimately, of course, we'd say Jesus is God. Look at these, and these quotes are on your paper. John chapter 14, verses 9 to 11. Philip said, "Lord, show us the Father, and that will be enough for us." Jesus answered, "Don't you know me, Philip, even after I have been among you such a long time? Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, 'Show us the Father'? Don't you believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? The words I say to you are not just my own. Rather, it is the Father living in me who's doing his work. Believe me when I say that I am in the Father and the Father is in me." So here you get this Jesus identity with God the Father. And of course, you know, the Trinity is a mysterious thing. I can give you all of the sanctioned language for talking about the Trinity, but let me just say, Jesus is worthy of our worship. Okay, Jesus is God. He is one of the persons of the Trinity. And in John 14, 9 to 11, to see this God of love, you merely need to look at Christ. To understand what love is, you need to simply look at Christ to worship him. John 15 verses 9 to 13. "As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Now remain in my love. If you obey my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have obeyed my Father's commands and remain in his love. I've told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. My command is this: love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends." In other words, Jesus himself saying, "I have loved you. If you want to know what to do, imitate me." In other words, God is love. You know, Jesus is God. Jesus is worthy of our worship. And because he's love, he's worthy of our imitation. When we want to understand what our duties are in love, we ought to be really taking the time to look at Christ and what he's done. And of course, we don't have to limit ourselves to just the New Testament, just to the earthly ministry of Christ. God is love. We can look at all of his relationship with his people, and being careful and doing our good homework, being careful with our exegesis, and we can look at all the ways that God relates to his people, and you have to say it's love. If God is love, he can't do anything that is not love. Now, we're not God either, right? So when God destroys a nation of people, that doesn't mean that we should go out and destroy a nation of people, but we need to understand the dynamics at work and all of God's interactions with his people and what the purposes are in it. All of that to say, love does not have to be a mystery to us. I mean, to our culture, love is a mystery. At best, it is an experience. It's something that people want to be in awe of, but it is a mystery. They don't know how to get it. They don't know how to hold on to it. You can't get two people who will agree on what it is. And Jesus says, hey, maybe it's a mystery in the sense that God is love, but you've seen God if you know Christ. You know what love is. It gets very specific. And in a couple of these passages, of course, 1 John 3:16 and in John chapter 15, what's highlighted there is God's sacrificial love for us in Christ. Sacrifice, the costliness of love, is something that's going to always need to be highlighted for us.